a little more clearly.
Yeah, I think that's fine. The revisions that we're seeing right now actually relate to the procedures. What am I thinking of? The national law procedure, which is not really the topic of this call. But we'll probably spend a minute or two briefly just sort of procedure at the start of the call just to clarify. I'd like to just keep working that on the list because I think that it's a better way to try to deal with edits to a document like that in any case.
Nicholas Sogren just joined.
So did Ross. Good morning, everyone.
Hi, Ross.
Jeff.
So did I hear someone else join as well? Other than Nicholas and Ross?
And Franny.
Oh, hi, Franny.
Hi, Jordan.
Wow. I think that we have every constituency on the call.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's pretty impressive. We do not have any ALAC representatives yet. Is that...
Rich is not able to be on the call. I don't know if Wendy will be able to.
Okay. Yeah, see, they wanted this super early slot on the West Coast, and then they don't show up for it. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and kick this off. In terms of an agenda for this call, I want to... Briefly review where we are on just some of the back and forth we've seen over the last couple hours on the draft, but I don't want to get into the substance of the national procedure conversation, just to talk about sort of next steps and how to move that forward. And then I'm going to move into a review of the accuracy topic, especially recapping the sort of Cape Town meeting and see if there's any concrete next steps we can take for there, and then wrap up with next steps and talking about the tiered access conversation for next week. Anyone else have anything they want to add to the agenda?
Hello.
Hello, Milton.
Kathy Kleiman also joined. Good morning, everyone.
Wow.
Hey, Kathy, how are you doing?
The commercial constituency is in force today.
We're all here.
We're taking over.
Cool.
Okay, so I'm going to jump right into then to a brief sort of discussion on the procedure, which is the procedure on resolving conflicts between national laws. We had quite a bit of dialogue on that topic this morning. We're not going to talk about the substance of that today, but I do encourage people to continue to work this on the list, and I see that there's a couple of people have commented on sort of perceived difficulties getting access to the document, which I haven't actually had a chance to sort of delve into it, but we will be... We probably will not be revisiting the... we won't have a call again probably on the procedure for resolving conflicts with national law until after the... we have a new charter, which hopefully will be not very long from now, in a couple of weeks. And at that point, in light of the new charter, we'll see... or new terms of reference, we'll see how it makes sense to frame those recommendations. And it does seem like we're... continuing to work that on the list, which I'm going to encourage everyone to do. And if no one has any...
Well, this is Steve.
Sure.
I'm just wondering why you seem to be suggesting we delay any action on this until after we get a new charter, which might tell us we shouldn't be working on this. Is that...
No, I'm saying we should continue to work it on the list. We're not going to have a call on it because we've already scheduled our next... We already have the topics of our next two calls scheduled, Steve. And by the time that those two calls have been conducted, we will have a new terms of reference. But I would certainly like that at the point we have a new terms of reference and we have a next call on this, that we're ready to take some sort of definitive action on it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, I am going to move then to hopefully we'll have a good discussion today on the topic of accuracy. Now, Bruce had forwarded back in March, and I had attempted to report. Did anyone get them? I didn't see the message myself. Did people get the message I forwarded, I think, yesterday with the summary of the Cape Town discussions? That silence I'm hearing probably sounds like people didn't get it.
I sent it back on the agenda as well.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Okay. Well, in any case, Bruce did have a good recap of the Cape Town discussions, and I tried to send it out yesterday. It sounds like Glenn has included it in the agenda as well, so if any of you want to look at your invitation to this meeting, the recap should be there. But Bruce isn't here, so I'm going to attempt to briefly recap sort of Cape Town as what I think would be a useful starting point for the discussion, and then suggest a couple of areas that we can discuss today. So I was not in this particular meeting in Cape Town, so I certainly encourage anyone on this call that was there to correct me if I'm reading Bruce's notes incorrectly. But basically what I'm getting from his note were there were a few sort of points of...
Jerry, can I just...
Yeah, sure, go ahead, Russ.
To ask whom on the call was actually at that meeting. I didn't get a complete roll call.
Yeah, that would actually be very helpful. Thanks, Russ. Anyone? Was there anyone on the call at that meeting in Cape Town?
I was.
Okay, Russ.
I was for a very short period of time. It's Tom. I just joined.
Tom Keller. Okay. Okay. So a couple of registrar reps, I guess, were there. Did you remember anyone else?
If I kind of remember who was there, I remember Marilyn being there, Bruce was there, Glenn was also there, Barbara was there.
Franny
I'm not sure if Franny was there or not.
I was meeting at 7:30 in the morning. I was
I believe Kiyoshi was there. And I really can't remember whom else. I know it was a fairly, 8 or 9 people in total.
And
right.
There was Philip Shepherd there from the council, too.
Right.
So
Ken was there as well, Ken, were you? No?
I think so, Ross, yes.
Okay. So Ross and Tom and Ken, I guess I'm relying on you to keep me honest here, because I was not there, and I'm recapping notes from Bruce, but...
Somebody else, yeah.
Exactly. So basically, Bruce's notes indicate that there were a few sort of general themes. First is that although that there's some members of the ICANN community that would like for registrars to sort of proactively verify the accuracy of information at the time of registration, but there was a strong sentiment among the registrars that would be very difficult logistically and raise the cost of registrations across the board significantly. So as a result of that, the discussion I think moved to a discussion of what basically there's been the focus of the discussion has been on getting in touch with the registrant, and for some reason not being able to do so as a result of inaccurate WHOIS information. And so as a result, it seems that there was some sort of inclination towards a sort of response or complaint-based approach as a way to address those sorts of issues. And essentially it sounds like that the process discussed in Cape Town was that a registrar would attempt to contact a registrant if they if there's a complaint about the who has information, and if for some reason they don't respond within 15 days, the name would be put on hold, and the registrant would be advised by the registrar that they need to update the information within another 15 days, so there's a total of 30 days, which at the end of that 30-day period, the name would be potentially canceled. And
Tim Ruiz with GoDaddy, Johnny. Sorry I'm late.
Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
And that the registrar could use any of the contact elements to try to get in touch with the registrant, so the registrar could use the phone number, the address, or email, whatever worked. And so that's, I think, a high-level view of that procedure. And then basically that procedure is designed to deal with inaccurate contact information. Bruce also mentions that there's the second issue of IP infringement, and there's some thought that because there might be some ongoing harm or some short-term harm, a 15 to 30-day process might not be good in that case. It may be desirable to develop some sort of procedure by which some sort of takedown notice method, like as applies to like the DMCA in the U.S. But I think what I'm getting from Bruce's notes is that seems to be more a matter for outside of ICANN's scope, that it would be good if there were ways that intellectual property holders could rapidly sort of take down a site independently of complaints about inaccuracy, but I can't tell if that's just Bruce's feeling or if that was a sentiment out of the Cape Town meeting, or that's sort of out of the scope of the task force. So that's a brief summary of the Cape Town notes that Bruce submitted. Does Ross or anyone else was at that meeting, do you have any other thoughts or corrections to that?
Yeah, I guess the only bit missing from this note, and I think it's a very important point, is that we didn't spend a lot of time talking about the business process itself as much as we talked about our requirements from that business process. And that's the real shame that's lost with these lack of notes coming out of this meeting. But I thought it was I remember a very, very healthy discussion around each constituency, and I don't mean that in terms of in an ICANN sense, but just in terms of stakeholdership, was really honest in putting out their requirements on the table and taking into account other people's requirements. So this one really focuses on business process a little bit more than what the meeting actually did. On the whole, though, I think it's a very fair characterization of what happened.
So you're saying that sort of maybe prior to some of this summary that Bruce has put forward, there was also a discussion of requirements from the various stakeholders or constituencies?
This was actually more of a straw man, and we each then went forth and said, well, here's what I would need from such a process. This may or may not address that, but then let's use this as something to move forward with and build on.
Okay, great. So let me propose a couple things as a way of framing our discussions today, and I'm glad to adjust this if people think it would be useful. But I'd like to hear a little bit about, first of all, what registrars are doing today in terms of, I know that there is a WHOIS complaint process in place, and just hear what the registrars are doing today and to what extent the various interests on the call believe that that process is not adequate, and then maybe take that a step further, and maybe we'll get some of the requirements out of that, and then take that a step forward to look at Bruce's straw man and see if that gets us any closer to meeting those requirements, or if there's another direction that might be useful as well. Does that seem productive? Okay, well, hopefully silence means yes instead of no. So I'm wondering, could any of the registrar reps on the call speak to either what you as a company do, or what you think the general practice of registrars may be today If there's complaints about inaccurate WHOIS information.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Tom, did you want to jump in as well?
Yeah, I'll certainly explain what we do.
Our process is very simple. And I'll speak to ComNet NOR because it's the vast majority of the work that we do. As a rule, we try not to make exceptions for our processes across TLDs, whether they be generic or sponsored or country code. Obviously, local policy within each of those TLDs causes us to create some exceptions, but by and large, they're pretty generic processes across all the TLDs we offer. When we receive a notice of inaccuracy, and I use the term notice because they come in a variety of form currently, either through the WHOIS problem reporting system by email, through telephone conversations, and so on, what we will do is put that to what we call our compliance department. And our compliance department is a team of individuals. And their job is to ensure that not only our resellers are operating within the confines of their contract, but our registrants are also operating within the confines of their contracts. They're really a reactive group within the company, and their job is pretty varied. They deal with UDRP complaints, WHOIS problem reporting system notices, phishing, spamming, you name it. Generally speaking, if you've got some sort of an issue with a domain, you'll probably end up there sooner or later with us. The process they follow is pretty straightforward for investigating inaccuracy. They'll take a look at it on its face. We'll typically send out an email notice describing the alleged inaccuracy within the or that was put forward to us. That will go out to the registrant contact, the admin, technical, and billing contacts for the domain name. That notice also describes the remediation process that the registrant or contacts must follow and the penalties for not doing so. The expected response is that the registrant or someone will correct that inaccuracy, and within a certain period of time, I believe, and don't quote me on, I guess this is being transcribed, so I'm already being quoted, but don't hold me to this. I believe that we're looking for action within 15 days. And if we don't receive action on that within 15 days or hear a response back from the registrant or one of the other contacts, we'll put the name on a registry hold. Now, the registry hold is, I may be misusing that term, it's a technical term, but it's intended to prevent the registrant from using their domain registration until either A, they correct the inaccuracy, or B, it naturally expires. In the event that we don't hear back from them by email, we will typically send out, as a last resort, before we actually take the name out of the zone, we'll send out a letter via regular post to the registrant contact. If that comes back undeliverable, the ultimate action that we'll take, if the name's been put on hold, is we'll actually expire the registration. If the registrant chooses to correct it, then we take it off hold or otherwise let them continue using it.
Okay, Russ, I have two quick follow-up questions on your procedure.
Yep.
When you say that if you don't receive a response like your postal mail inquiry or you get it back, you say you'll actually expire the name. Does that mean you wait for the natural expiration, or do you actually delete the name? And then the second question is, if people come back and give you an additional set of information, do you take any steps to validate that it's more accurate than the previous set of information?
No, we do not.
Right. Okay, so you just wait for new information of some sort, and then you release the hold.
That's right. As I described that group, it's extremely reactive. I would say the bulk of their time in order is dealing with A, accuracy issues, B, UDRP issues, and then C, transfer issues. So the amount of time they've actually got to devote to each task is relatively limited.
Great, thanks. Anyone else have questions for us?
I would have some questions for us.
Kathy, too.
Steve, I also.
Okay, hold on a second. So Milton, Kathy, Steve, anyone else? Okay, go ahead, Milton.
Hi, Ross.
Hi, Milton. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to You know, when you, when these complaints come in about the information being inaccurate, obviously, do you as a registrar ever have trouble contacting the registrar
in terms of
billing and so on?
Of course, of course. One thing to keep in mind is that our model is very disintermediated, meaning that we don't actually have billing information on any of our customers. As a result, we're subject to the same inaccuracy issues that anybody else using the WHOIS data would. The only data that we actually collect is the data that we're required to collect under the ICANN contracts. So it's not like we've got a credit card number on file for any of these people or anything like that.
Okay. So you're relying on your intermediaries to actually have that information?
Yeah. If you actually look at the data we collect in Trulia here, you'll be very disappointed in its depth. Other than things like, here's the last time they logged in to manage their name, and the IP address that they came to, you know, sort of that technical stuff, there's not much there at all. One of the things that we work very diligently on is tracking bounces when we send out notices and all sorts of other things to make sure that that when we are looking for money, that we've got the best chances possible of getting it. So, you know, accuracy is something that that we tend to take pretty seriously because of those reasons.
Okay. And how many names in general are you aware of that Tsukaus has taken down because of inaccuracy?
You know, I don't know. I could find out, I could report back. I don't have that number off the top of my head.
And then the other question is, I mean, our perspective on this as a constituency is that it doesn't make a lot of sense to address these accuracy issues until the privacy issues have been addressed. Do you think that's a factor in inaccurate data?
I would tend to agree with that, yeah. As somebody who has regularly had bad data in his WHOIS records because he doesn't like being called at home by one of the 4 million customers that he serves, you know, I can certainly relate to the privacy concerns.
Okay, that is all. You're a witness.
Thanks, Milton. Kathy?
Actually, following up on Milton, surprise, surprise. Russ, when a registrant submits revised information, is it possible for them to ask your team not to post that revised information on the website? Can they say they're a home business, a human rights group? Is it possible to provide the accurate information and request some kind of privacy on that?
We don't offer a privacy product currently, so no. Technically, no is the answer. There's no real practical or theoretical exception to that. You know, if they can give us inaccurate data and hide behind it, you know, that's certainly the case.
So it could be new data that's inaccurate?
Correct.
Okay.
Thanks,
cool. Kathy. That was it. Thank you.
Steve?
Yeah. Ross, thank you for this walking us through the process. I really just have one question. And as you said, all of these different statuses are kind of terms of art here, so I just want to make sure, when you say registry hold, as what you do when you don't get a response within 15
mm-hmm.
days or whatever the time limit is that the same thing as what Bruce is talking about in his post, which is the name would be put on hold, i.e. removed from the zone file and made inactive? Is that
yes.
what you guys do?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Steve, just to clarify, there's in both EPP and RRP, there's a sort of technical flag that can be set on a domain that leaves it in the registry database, but not in the zone file.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions for Ross? Thanks, Ross, for that spontaneous bit of help. Tim, do you have anything that you wanted to add or distinguish from what Tsukaus does?
No, I think we handle things pretty much very, very similarly to that. I guess I would just say that, you know, it's how we attempt to contact the registrant or the admin contact might be a little different. In that we start with email, but very often that can fail if the data is inaccurate. We will attempt to do to try to contact them by phone or through other means, but we seldom will actually, in fact, I don't believe at all, do we actually try to send anything to the postal address. So if we don't get a response, the name's on hold. We don't leave it there indefinitely. If within a reasonable time after the name's on hold, we don't hear anything from the registrar, we will delete the name.
Okay, thanks. And the current accreditation agreement, I believe, gives registrars the option of deleting the name for inaccurate information after 15 days. Is that right?
Right. But yeah, I think it's within the first. You need to give at least 15 days for a response. After that, it is at the registrar's option to actually delete the name.
Okay. Any questions for Tim?
This is Steve. I have one question.
Yeah, sure, Steve.
Tim, do you know what time during what time period during what time period after you receive a complaint do you try to contact the registrant? And
we give it 10 days. If after 10 days we haven't been able to contact them or had a response, then the name is put on hold.
And also similarly to what Ross was saying, if you do get a response with new data, do you check that data out at all?
Just for reasonableness, I mean, you know, if we usually tell the registrar it's going to take 24 hours to reactivate their name while we validate the data. But honestly, you know, it's just more or less, you know, does it look reasonable? Does it address the issue that was complained about? For example, if the complaint was there was no phone number or the phone number was disconnected, you know, do we get a different phone number? I'm not saying we necessarily call that number to find out if it's any good or not, but we just try to make sure that the actual complaint that was filed, that information was addressed by the registrant.
What if it wasn't? What would you do?
Then we'd respond back to the registrar and tell them that, you know, that they hadn't made the changes that they had stated and that the name wouldn't be taken off hold.
Okay.
We'd give them a chance to respond.
What if that came in during the first 10 days before you had put it on hold? What if a non-responsive response, if you will, that came in within the first 10 days? Would you...
Good question. I couldn't tell you specifically, but I would imagine the clock would just keep ticking.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Kathy, do you have a question?
Yeah, Tim, same question that Milton asked Russ. Do you have any idea how many names you've deleted over time for accuracy issues?
Yeah, I knew you were going to ask that, and I honestly don't know for sure how many we've actually deleted. Well, one of the things I asked ICANN for, and I think might be, I don't know what other registrars might think of it, but, you know, when they do their WDRS report, it would be interesting to see that on an individual registrar basis, just, you know, privately to each registrar what their individual stats are. That would kind of give us something to compare what we think we're doing against what ICANN is seeing.
Is it your sense that this is would it be done once a month, once a week, once every 6 months?
I'm sorry, Kathy, I don't understand the question.
Any kind of approximate, any kind of ballpark figure on takedowns?
I'd really hate to offer one. I mean, I could try to find out. I mean, I just don't, this is not data I get on a regular basis.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Jordan?
Yeah, Ken?
Yeah. It's becoming clear to me that we need to start looking at materiality in terms of some of these issues. The scenario that Steve pointed out, for instance, so, you know, it would be extremely helpful in the future if there was some way of accumulating the kind of data to determine just exactly how significant it is. My guess is, and it's just a wild WAG, as we would say, that the number that Tim was asked for is so insignificantly small compared to the number of domains that GoDaddy has under management that it has to be almost lost. And I think one of the problems that you run into in a circumstance like that is that registrars today are doing as much automation as possible in order to keep their costs down so that they can pass the resultant savings through to registrants and stay competitive. And I think that a process that Steve was querying Tim about is almost so far outside of the normal day-to-day procedures that I'm guessing that in some cases it may not even be something that's really even documented in the daily operating procedures for a registrar. You know, who's going to make the call? Who's going to follow up and check on credibility? Now, I don't know how many names GoDaddy has under management, but let's assume it's well in excess of 5 million names. If this has happened 10 or 15 times where they've resubmitted the data and the data has been looked at for reasonableness and then followed up on when it's unreasonable, I can understand the kind of issues that Tim would have in his own company in trying to establish a process to deal with something that's so far out of the realm of what they deal with that it, you know, I just think that we need to get a handle on how material this really is. How many times does this happen? Is it 0.1%? You know, whatever it may be.
Just to clarify one thing, that what the way it's handled at GoDaddy is we handle it through the fraud department. So this information doesn't come to compliance or to the typical domain services team. It actually goes to fraud, and they deal with it there.
Greg Ruth joining.
I'm not sure what kind of records they're keeping, or you know, it's not reports that I see at least.
So Tim, that would be the same team that looks at like stolen credit cards and chargebacks and things like that?
Exactly.
Okay. Any other questions for Tim? I actually do. So this discussion of numbers has actually inspired me to think a little bit about the Who Is Data reporting process. Maria, does ICANN track at all the sheer volume of complaints handled through that process, and the outcomes sort of one way or the other as to whether a satisfactory result was achieved?
Jordan, I'm not entirely sure. I think we do track the numbers, but I'm not sure about any qualitative data. But I can find out and get back to people on the mailing list about it.
Okay, that may help, but I guess you're only seeing complaints that people make through the ICANN process. Theoretically, I don't know, Ross and Tim could clarify, but there could be complaints issued, I mean, made directly to the registrars as well, right, that you wouldn't necessarily see the numbers on.
Right, and also, I mean, we do get copied on a lot of complaints, or, you know, people often send a complaint to the registrar and to ICANN and to, I mean, any email they can find, so there may be a bit of overlap. I'd say it's probably insignificant.
Yeah, we actually have a link in our Who Is to report bad Who Is data, and it doesn't link to Internet reporting system, or to ICANN. It links to a form on our own site. So that data obviously isn't going to be included in ICANN.
Right.
So, and I don't have numbers on that directly either, but I think last I was aware, we probably receive at least as many complaints through that process as we get from ICANN.
Okay. So ICANN. So you suggested earlier, Tim, that maybe ICANN could gather as part of their just general sort of survey or compliance surveys they do to registrars to ask questions about the number of incidents, I guess, instead of just relying on the complaints that they had received directly.
Yeah, and I guess even other than that, you know, they do a report on the WDRS, whatever that acronym is, I can't recall. The Who Is Data Reporting System, they've done a few reports. obviously they're able to look at that probably by registrar if they wanted to. And I guess what we'd be interested in would be, you know, an individual report, you know, that a report like that, but it's just specific for GoDaddy. So we can look at our numbers and say, well, here's what ICANN has statistically for GoDaddy on this reporting system. Does that match up with what we're doing internally? You know, what are we missing? How could we improve? But looking at it, it's just hard to look at that overall report and then relate that back specifically to us and our business.
Sure. Okay, understood. So that may be, that seems like probably a suggestion we could just make to Maria without necessarily, that's not necessarily a policy change required to
right.
get those sorts of changes implemented. So that does seem like a good suggestion we might want to take to the staff. Okay, so I want to move this, actually, Tom, do you have anything you want to add from the perspective of Schlund in terms of, do you guys do anything differently than what Tim and Ross have described?
Yeah, no, absolutely not. We have a compliance department as well, and everything that comes in there will be dealt with. And if we find out that someone is not giving back an address or a new address, we kind of cancel the domain name. We don't really close it or delete it, but we will wait until it expires. But it will be of no use during that time, so that's pretty much the same policy we have for the others.
Okay, so the one difference, though, is you'll just put it on registrar hold and allow it to naturally expire versus proactively deleting it at
Absolutely.
Some point.
Okay. So if he wants to transfer the domain name, it's out of our sponsorship, and that's not our problem anymore.
Okay.
But I want to add that it's barely happened. So we get, like, maybe one or two of the ICANN reports a month, and besides that, we don't get any kind of contacts from the outside and complaints that concern the accuracy of our data.
Thanks. And I'll just add, taking off my chair hat for 1 second, that the sort of certainly the order of magnitude of complaints that Register.com gets is extraordinarily low relative to the volume of domains under sponsorship. I mean, if we got one a day, that would be. I mean, it's not nearly one a day, which would be 365 a year for a domain base of 2.5 million or something like that. So, the order of magnitude is quite low compared to the number of domains. It's probably a tiny fraction of a hundredth of a percent during any given year. Okay, so I want to. So with that in mind, sort of a baselining against the status quo, which actually sounds somewhat similar to a large extent to Bruce's straw man. I'd like to hear from anyone who cares to comment in terms of how registrars' current procedures are. How we view these as not meeting needs of the various constituencies, and whether there's any specific suggestions for improvement as to those procedures, and we can sort of see how the discussion proceeds from there.
This is Steve. Can I make a comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone else want to speak to this? Okay, Steve, go ahead.
I think that what's been described from the two registrars is pretty similar to what Bruce Tonkin laid out. That's why I asked this question about registry hold, just to make sure that he was talking about the same thing that Ross was talking about and that I assume Tim was talking about. I think two questions that arise... there's three questions. First, there was some discussion within Task Force 3 about whether there ought to be some standard for which contact points the registrar uses to try to get the registrant to respond to a report of bad contact data. I think Tim described using a couple of different means. Ross described using one means only, which was email, and I know that was one issue that was discussed within Task Force 3, although I don't know exactly where that came to rest. The second issue is one that you raised, Jordan, and that is what is done when you get a response from the registrant. Is there any vetting of that response to make sure it's responsive to the complaint that was made and to make sure that the data that was submitted is accurate? And Tim indicates that there is some quick look at this. Ross indicated there was no look at this. This is a documented problem that a registrant will respond to a report of false data by providing new false data. This has been going on for many years, and this is one issue that I think a policy ought to address. If, in fact, the volume of complaints is as low as Jordan and Tom say it is, then it would be it would not be a great burden to ask the registrars to look at this data when it comes in. The third point is really goes back to Bruce's posting, and it's really just to make sure that it's clear that this is there is a fast track procedure. This doesn't rule out a registrar agreeing to a faster procedure in certain circumstances, and that's really point three, I think, of Bruce's posting. So those are my comments on it. I do think it lines up pretty well with what Bruce said, but I think there's the question of how many contact points the registrar uses to try to contact the registrant. There's the issue of authenticating or validating the data that the registrant does send it. And then the third point is providing for a faster procedure in certain circumstances.
Jordan, this is Tim. Would it be appropriate for me to make a comment on that? Or
yeah, I'd like in to response talk to, that as well. To Steve, yeah. So certainly. So Tim, Ross, any other responses to Steve?
I do.
Okay, Tom. Okay, go ahead, Tim.
I just want to point out that, you know, when we get that new data, what we've first established is that we can contact this individual. So to us, that's the primary issue, that we have somebody contactable on the other end. You know, they can give us, you know, we can look at this data, we can, you know, take other steps to try to validate it. It doesn't mean that it's any more correct than the data that was there before. It just might look more correct. To us, the primary issue is that, yes, we can definitely contact this individual on the other end. So if there are issues, if there's problems, we know there's somebody there that's going to respond. And to us, that's far more important than just, you know, how pretty or accurate or reasonable the data might look. And that's really all we can ever say, is that this is how it looks. There's no guarantee, it's almost impossible to guarantee that data actually identifies the individual on the other end, only that we can contact somebody on the other end.
Thanks, Tim. Ross?
Yeah, just you know, judging by the sort of the tone and tenor of the comments so far on this, you know, we're just getting into it. It almost sounds like we're about to rehash 18 months of discussions that went absolutely nowhere. So, you know, with that cynical view in mind, we should be careful of putting too much stock in the notion of the number of contact points that a registrar must validate in order for a record to be accurate. The current contact set within the WHOIS is pretty much a joke as it stands today. The practical difference between the admin contact, the technical contact, and the billing contact was lost somewhere in 1992 or thereabouts. Typically, that will be a service provider or a DNS operator or something similar to that. So we're really left with two contacts, the registrant contact and everything else. And I think it's important for us to make sure that contactability is stressed and not necessarily the percentage of accurate data within the record. If the registrant or somebody associated with the registrant is contactable and they can do something about the problem at hand, then I think we've achieved our objectives. fast tracking is a bit of a sticky wicket. In that, at the end of the day, registrars and to a certain degree registries do have a high degree of discretion as it relates to what happens with domains. For all intents and purposes, I can go into my database of registrations right now, pick a name at random, and put it on hold with very little regard to what the ICANN contracts are, my contracts with the registries, and that's because of that agreement that we have with those registrants. That's my way of saying that we will always have the right to implement a fast-track process if indeed there is there are issues that must be dealt with expediently. I think it's probably a waste of our time if we were to spell out each and every fast-track process that we may wish to implement. At the end of the day, we've got to keep in mind that our goal here is to ensure the security and stability of the system, make sure that it's usable for registrants, and operates within a legal framework that's consistent with the various jurisdictions that we operate in. To define every aspect of the business that we're dealing with, I think, is just not a healthy route for industry, for registrants, or really for anybody, for that matter. The last point I wanted to, it's not even a point, it was more of a question. Steve, you said that the revalidation problem was a documented issue. Could you point us in the direction of some of that documentation?
The most obvious example is the OECD situation that was the subject of a presentation at the Bucharest meeting of ICANN, and where it was one of those rare registrants that could afford to actually pursue this all the way around the world and find out that the entity whose domain name was initially hijacked.
So that's one case.
That false data, you know, the registrant was able to submit false data time and again, and it was accepted time and again.
Right, so that's one case, though.
Yeah.
Okay. Are there any other that you're aware of? Or?
Oh, there's... I know anecdotally about other cases. It seems obvious to me that if a registrant wants to hide his or her identity or some of the contact information, the current system enables them to do it because they can simply, as long as they have one contact point,
yeah,
one Hotmail account that they respond to, they can provide a lot of other false contact data in response, and certainly at two cows, it won't be looked at again.
Sure, So one of the point I'd like to make on that,
at least briefly, but and so the question is, should there be some standard here in that?
Well, that's exactly my point, Steve. I think that, you know, the one thing that we fell into the trap of under Task Force 3 was that we spent a lot of time dealing with what I would characterize as boundary cases. So the current registration policy framework allows registrants, registrars, and registries to do a lot of different things. By and large, those capabilities aren't executed on. In the cases that they are, I think we've got a very, very strong set of contracts that will obviously do something about it. But for us to kind of dive down deep to the point where we're creating policy to deal with boundary cases, I don't think that's a useful exercise for this task force.
Okay. Thanks, Russ. Tom?
Well, yeah, I should just want to reiterate what Tim said, and want to add that dealing with false data is very tough on us because there's no way to really find out whether it's valid data or not. So if it looks good, the only thing we can do is try to contact the person under this data, and if it responds, we have to assume that it's correct. I mean, they're often very funny addresses. The only thing we can figure out are Mickey Mouse's and Donald Duck's, and the other stuff might look good, but it's still false. I mean, that's a very often already brought up problem that you can't, you know, judge on view whether it's correct or not. So if Steve has a methodology on how to do that, I would be very happy, and I guess our fraud department would be very happy about that as well. But that's the point, that it's one of the foundations of this discussion, that it's always demanded to recheck data, but it's a virtual impossibility to do so.
Thanks, Tom. Actually, I just wanted to ask it. Ross raised a couple of issues, and I want to just clarify, Steve, what you were saying. First of all, when talking about the fast track, what I glean from your comments on number three is that you don't think a policy should rule out a fast track option. Is that what you're saying? Are you saying that we ought to contemplate how to implement a fast track within the task force?
No, that's what I'm saying. I don't have any disagreement with what Ross said on that.
Okay. And then my other question, I guess, is that you in terms of the number of contact points that are used, I think I heard what you said a little differently as well. You said that there's some discussion, or there ought to be some discussion around how many contact points are used to try to get in touch with the registrant when verifying the information, as opposed to how many are verified to be accurate. Which
that's correct. You heard me correctly.
Okay, so you're just saying that we may want to have some sort of standard, like when you're trying to get in touch with someone in order to bring their information up to date, there may be some, you're suggesting that we might want to create some standard for how many different ways we try to get in touch with them.
Think, you know, the issue here is you obviously don't want to have situations where people who have... who are contactable simply aren't contacted because the registrar says, well, we're only going to check one thing. We're only going to send them an email. And if they don't respond to an email, their domain is going to go on registry hold. Obviously, from the standpoint of a registrant, which is, of course, the viewpoint that all of our constituencies are taking as users, there's some risk of abuse there because perhaps the email address is, you're not no longer responding to that email address, but your phone number is still good. So that's the issue, and I don't have a fixed view on how many there ought to be, but I think you accurately stated what the issue was that, as I understand it, was discussed within Task Force 3, and I know that whole thing was a very bad experience for us, but I don't think that we should dismiss out of hand that issue.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. So, anyone else have any comments as to problems they see with the status quo practices or policies as described by the registrars on the call today?
Jordan, this is Kathy. Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure, Kathy.
I apologize if I've missed something. Steve, I don't really understand the fast-track procedure that you've mentioned and discussed. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
I was referring to the third point of Bruce's posting, that there could be some circumstances where there needs to be a faster response than 15 days. But I agree that it's probably not feasible for within this process to spell out what those situations are.
Okay, thank you.
Right, so I think the key here is if there were some sort of either developed through another ICANN process or if it was outside the scope of ICANN, developed through national laws or whatever, some sort of takedown methodology. I mean, I know in the U.S., hosting providers and ISPs at least sort of... are subject to, or have intellectual property holders have the right to provide them with takedown notices under the DMCA, which does two things: allows them to get pretty fast responses to take down sort of if they see intellectual property infringement, and also the flip side of that is shields the ISP or content provider from liability to a certain extent, I think.
Jordan, are we talking about accuracy at this point, or are we
I'm just saying this is a like procedure that is not actually. I don't think actually applies to registrars or to accuracy issues. I'm just saying that this is an example of a type of external fast track that theoretically someone could craft something like this, something similar to that. That related to accuracy or who knows what within a national law context, and people would have to obey that probably. And I guess we just want to, it sounds like Steve's just saying that we don't want to preclude those sorts of options if they exist. So it sounds to me like if that third point actually doesn't seem too controversial to me, that we don't preclude fast-track options that are developed independently of this policy. So it seems to me that it may be useful to continue to think about these first two issues that Steve raised, which are really the only differentiating points from the status quo procedure, is whether there should be a standard for which points of contact or how many points of contact a registrar uses before giving up and putting a name on hold or deleting it, and secondly, to try to whether or not there should be some standard for validating responses that are made, or updates that are made to data. It seems to me if we were to address or at least have some further discussion around those two points, we would probably deal with most of the sort of, we'll call it, low-hanging fruit or the problems that we see with status quo procedures or policies as they're implemented today. Am I missing anything? Because that seems like a relatively manageable scope for accuracy discussions within this task force.
Well, hello?
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't know if I was on mute or not. There would also be the issue of creating standardized reporting systems. I think there's a lot of value to the WDPRS, and I think finally institutionalizing that to an appreciable degree would be very helpful, not only to registrars, but to the outside community as well.
And you're talking about standardizing reporting systems, like additional requirements for registrars, or just a refinement of how ICANN reports data?
Making the use of the WDPRS reporting system, is that a recursive acronym? The WHO's data problem reporting system, making that a mandatory part of this policy. In other words, if somebody has a complaint about accuracy, that's what they would use to file a complaint. Registrars would be obligated to take certain actions based on certain quality of service requirements or what have you.
Okay, so I guess
closing tickets, et cetera.
Sure.
Right?
I mean, the flip side of that, I guess, is that registrars could also, if they received, instead of making that the mandatory contact point, just registrars could notify ICANN whenever they received a complaint as well.
No, I'm not describing it in the sense of making sure that it's an accurate way of getting reports out of the system, Jordan. I'm describing the sense of it allowing registrars to be more efficient in dealing with these types of concerns, creating a more predictable process for registrants and for people filing complaints. So it's not as, I'm not talking about accumulating more data, even though that is a side effect of actually implementing it.
Okay, so you're saying we could take perhaps Steve's suggestions combined with yours and make a more defined and streamlined process that registrars take in terms of reacting to complaints about data problems?
That's right.
Yeah.
Could I get in the discussion here?
Yeah, certainly. Milton, anyone else want to join? Okay, go ahead, Milton.
Okay, I just think there's a certain quality of unreality about these detailed discussions about accuracy, because again, as I indicated earlier, it really makes no sense to go any further than we have gone on accuracy without addressing the data access and privacy considerations. And I think that I know that there are people who don't want to address those considerations, and that is in fact the danger here, that we get all wrapped up in discussions of detailed ways of dealing with the accuracy problem, but in fact one of the biggest accuracy problems we have is that people, you know, are afraid to put their data in there because it's open, and until we do something about that, there will be there's both you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to be investing lots of time and policy and registrar resources into improving accuracy. And I just think that the people who are most concerned about accuracy need to accept that fact and work with us to deal with the privacy problems. And you'd be surprised at how cooperative you'll find us on the accuracy issue once those privacy issues are taken care of. So I would object to any kind of detailed discussion of proposals of doing anything at this time until we have, you know, dealt with issues in a proper priority.
Thanks, Milton. And once again, in terms of prioritization, I will suggest that we are going to get a new terms of reference soon, and that's a worthy topic for discussion. I think it belongs at the council level in relationship to what our new terms of reference are going to look like. I will note that we are going to next week have a discussion on the access topic, which could include limiting access to data and providing some sort of privacy for registrants, and I think that is an important item that's also part of the work effort that is contemplated by the informal agreement we had in Mar del Plata for moving ahead with this task force, and I do think it is important that we advance that work as well. Any other comments on this? Okay, so I'm going to suggest that that based on our conversation today, it seems like the next step for us on the accuracy topic, to the extent that we are working on the accuracy topic, is to focus on developing a standardized sort of procedure for reacting to complaints about data, as Ross suggests, and specifically that we should look at the two areas that Steve has noted, which are reviewing whether or not there should be requirements for registrars in terms of making attempts to contact a certain number or specific set of the contact points that they have available for the registrant or admin contact or whoever, any of the contact data available. And secondly, whether upon receiving a response with new WHOIS data, there should be any standard or any methods used to validate that information prior to reinserting it into the WHOIS record. And hearing no objection to that, I think we will be focusing. Then we will try to focus our work on the accuracy topic there. What I would certainly encourage Steve, Ross, and anyone else who has some interest in seeing elements of this advance is as we've seen on both the notice topic and the procedure to resolve conflicts with national laws, the best way to move this stuff ahead is for people to draft language and forward it to the list. We do see pretty healthy discussion on the list around specific recommendations. So I would encourage people to do that. Actually, I'll go so far as to ask whether there's if anyone would like to volunteer to take a first crack at drafting something, and there could be more than one volunteer for each of these in any of those three areas.
I don't mind doing something, Jordan.
Okay, Ross. Anyone else?
Yeah, this is Steve. I may be able to draft something.
Okay. Great. So if you guys can, once again, we won't have a call probably on this topic for 3 weeks or so. But the sooner you get stuff to the list, I think the more fleshed out and useful our dialogue on the list will be. But I think we'll get noted in Maria's action points, which have been very helpful. That we do have, I think, a few areas to focus on moving ahead, and we'll try to do that. So with that in mind, I'm going to wrap up this part of the conversation, and note that we are going to have a call on the access topic next week. Once again, I encourage people, if they have specific ideas to approach the access topic, I encourage you to submit them on the list. There were a few things that we had either in Task Force 2 or the combined task force that may be useful, and I'll look over Task Force 1 as well. I'll try to reforward them to the list, and hopefully this time my forwards to the list will actually get distributed in terms of giving us some framework. But I think the more concrete ideas we have next week to discuss, the better off we'll be. And encourage everyone to try to do that. So does anyone else have any other business they'd like to discuss before we wrap up the call? Okay, thanks everyone for your participation this morning, and we will resume next week discussing access to group data.
Thanks. Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks. Bye-bye.